We have the pleasure this morning, instead of the Simari's ambassador, we have Constancio Pinto, who is the Minister Counselor and Chargé d'Affaires of the embassy. That's the only change in the lineup this morning. You know, what I know about East Timor is so limited that it's even hard for me to introduce this session, but maybe I can do it simply by saying that so there may be people surprised by the recent difficulties in East Timor. And certainly, if I had judged by the president's visit and dinner we had with him in this room in January, I would be surprised too. The fact of the matter is that in post-conflict situations around the world, there are often difficulties, not just a year or two after, but for many years after a peace has been apparently established on a firm basis. This is not unusual. The usual statistic that people cite is that 50% of peace agreements end up with people going back to war one way or another, not necessarily with the guys they were at war with previously. That doesn't make the situation in East Timor any less painful to those who are concerned about it, either East Timorese or the scholars and international officials whom we have here today who have followed the situation for a long time. Nor does it mean that we should ignore the situation or in any way failed to respond appropriately to it. The question really is, how does one respond appropriately to it? What is all of this about? How does one respond now that East Timor is a sovereign state? How does one respond without infringing on East Timor's sovereignty? And how does one respond in a way that not only respects his sovereignty, but also furthers the democratic process in East Timor and elsewhere, frankly, because there will be many looking to East Timor as an example of how the international community responds in a situation of this sort. So with those remarks, I'll check again whether Mr. Hasegawa is on the phone.
Yes, I am here, yeah.
It's a pleasure to have you with us, even if electronically. You know the Institute well. You know we'll be interested in what you have to say about the real situation there on the ground. I wonder if you could take 5 or 10 minutes to outline your perspective. We always worry when people are on the phone that we'll lose you, so the best thing to do is get the most important things out first. And then we'll try to have a question or two for you, Mr. Hasegawa, before you leave us. And we appreciate your being with us. I know it's very late there in East Timor. The floor is yours.
Okay, that's quite fine. Let me just start my short remarks with what is happening now. That maybe newspaper will carry the coverage later on today, but just a few hours ago, the President Chanana Gusmao announced that he is resigning as a president tomorrow, unless Prime Minister Maria Ripati submits his resignation. This took place after the long session that the Council of State had yesterday. They met almost whole day to find out what would be the best for the country to be united and move forward. As you know, that there are more than 140,000 displaced persons out of the population of only about 180,000 to 190,000 people in the capital city of Delhi. We have a about 65,000 people in the displaced camps, in about 35 camps in the Heri, and the rest, about 60-70, have left Sebi and went to the eastern region. There is a dead silence now in town, and we do not know what will happen tomorrow when the demonstrators who are coming into the city from both east and west, they intend to demonstrate in front of the government palace. But that avenue has now been totally blocked by the security forces. This situation, I am very concerned, may result in another violence that we experienced on the 28th of April. Now, let me come to the some of the questions that have been put before me. The first one is, did the UN withdraw from Timor-Leste too early? Well, my response is, yes, indeed. There has been a sense that we tend to leave conflict areas too soon and that we should take a longer-term view. Secretary General Kofi Annan did propose that peacekeeping forces to remain here, but some of the member states disagreed and they thought that Timor-Leste is firmly on the strong ground and that the international community can direct the attention to other conflict areas. As you recall, that Secretary General mentioned that we were hoping that the newly formed Peacekeeping Commission could function to help us assess the medium and long-term vision of the situation. And I certainly agree with him that a country like Timor-Leste should be put on the agenda of the Peacebuilding Commission. Number of people have asked me what are the reasons for the sudden outbreak of this virus. And I can say that tension has been building up for the last 2 years. And let me touch upon some of the reasons that I find are the perhaps root causes of the conflict in this country. First, in my view, that the government has acquired relatively more confidence and authority as the international assistance concentrated in raising the capacity of the government initially. Three other sovereign state institutions have made also some progress, but far less than the government. Secondly, that the office of the president achieved considerable progress in building its capacity to review laws enacted by the parliament, and with the advisory assistance provided by ABICET and UNOTEL, in establishing the two key organs of the state, the Council of State and the Superior Council of Defense and Security. You know that the National Parliament started playing its legislative role in 2002, but has not acquired enough expertise to scrutinize the policies and the programs of the government. Also, the judiciary remained relatively weak until 2005, when the national judges, prosecutors, and defense lawyers started attending an organized form of training for 2 years. So what I'm here saying is that there has been an unbalanced development among the four state institutions, and the government has become very strong with the very strong will of the Prime Minister at the center, and that it has acquired great deal of power and authority. The tension has been building up for the last 2 years because the government also has maintained and strengthened highly centralized decision-making system and an exclusive political structure. In my view, the Prime Minister's authoritative style of conducting business and the subservient attitude of the many of his ministers resulted in the government not being able to respond efficiently and effectively to the grievances of people for fair, transparent, and accountable public administration. Also, there was a tendency on the part of the certain cabinet members to view grievances and the demands as a hostile act and to dismiss them until they were forced to address them, as was shown in their response to the 594 petitioners' call for an end to discrimination. And also, the attitude of the leaders has been seen as arrogant and insensitive to the people of Timor-Leste, where that kind of sentiment is highly important in forming the attitude and the views of the people. The President Analogous Mao, on the contrary, that shows his empathy and compassion towards the people, which has been well received. So the government is perceived increasingly as a cold entity that cares less about the people. Now, I know, having worked with the Prime Minister and the government, perhaps this is not fair. I think the government has been functioning and trying their best to deliver basic social services such as education, health, care, and the building up the infrastructure facilities. But the people's perception counts a great deal in the determining their perception. And also, let me mention about the massive unemployment that exists, particularly among the youth. We discussed a great deal, I myself with the Prime Minister, the need to carry embark upon the public work. But this was 3 years ago, and that the government and the Prime Minister decided that they do not want to borrow from the World Bank and other financing institutions for fear that they will become totally controlled by the banks and so forth. Now, I think I share great news with their sentiment. But I think as they now receive great deal of revenues from the natural gas resources, they are in the position to spend more money for the public works and the capital investment. In fact, they started doing it. The Prime Minister increased the budget, national budget, from $78 million 2 years ago to $120 million last year. And they are proposing further increase from $100 million to $220 million for the fiscal year starting 1st of July. And in view of the latest crisis, the financial department decided to top up with another $100 million to amount to about $320 million for a country with gross domestic product of only about $400 million outside of the oil sector. This is a significant amount. But this is received by the public in a mixed way. That it is seen as a maneuver to prepare the president's victory in the coming election. Despite the tangible achievements made in the building the functioning state structure in Shimoda since 1999, I think the growth in the confidence of four state institutions I mentioned does make a difference. And also, I may add that the lack of transparency and accountability is affecting the perception of the people. Also, fifthly, the politicization of the both the TNC police and the DPO defense forces, I consider is another fundamental cause for the current crisis. The disintegration of TNCO in Delhi resulted from the breakdown of unity in command and control due to political interference. I spoke with the Prime Minister on this point and he agreed that he wasn't quite aware of why the TNCO run away at that time. Our ample advisors have consistently advised the PNCO commanders to maintain the integrity of the national independent institution. But the deployment of SDPO, the military forces, by the government in a succinct order on the 28th April, created such a strong sense of fear and suspicion among the PNCO officers that they literally felt mistrust and even threat among their own members, leading to the disintegration of the PNCO as an organization. The divide between so-called Rodomodu and Rodotae, the West and the East, played a major disruptive role as PNTL members, mostly from the Western District, abandoned their post in sympathy with the petitioners. I must emphasize this divide between the East and the West hardly existed. And I let me tell you that having served also in Somalia and Rwanda, in the Rwanda, I was there for 2 years, right after the genocide, how the people's mind can be manipulated so easily is a very frightening factor that I think we have to really recognize and be able to deal with. Fundamental cause of crisis, I find it, is the mindset of the certain leaders of the security agencies and even in the government and the other state institutions. This mindset has made them prone to the use of force for the purpose of settling disputes or increasing their personal power. The use of force has by the independent struggle against foreign oppression. The seeds for violence were nurtured in the minds of the people and the entrenched mindset, negating the evils in some of the leaders who did not hesitate to use force against those whom they regard as their enemy and even distributed arms among unauthorized civilians to execute their instructions. So, these are some of the issues that perhaps I thought you might be interested in hearing, and I recognize now I have spoken more than 20 minutes, maybe more than I deserve, so I didn't stop and receive any questions.
Mr. Ambassador, if you can stay with us for a moment, there may be a couple of questions for you. Can I? Please.
Mr. Hasegawa, I have a quick question for you.
Could you identify yourself?
Okay. My name is Francisca. I'm an East Timorese student who right now is studying in Hawaii. And right now I'm doing my internship in D.C. My first question, as a person who right now in East Timor, based on your observation, who will be responsible for things that happen right now? Government, petitioners, or gangs who are doing the burning around country, or East Timorese people, or Minister of Interior of Rodrigo Lobato? And second question, I know my government kind of delayed, tried to take some quick action to solve the problem of 600 petitioners. My question, while being studied outside, I'm following the news, and I was waiting to hear something from UN at that time. Unless UN sends some message or say something through media to push or pressure the government that that time the situation is important and is in the problem, is serious, and government needs to take some quick action. And I just hear the UN say after 2 weeks when the things are already getting worse, why it takes so long for UN to say something at that time?
Mr. Hasegawa, did you hear that? The two questions. Who's responsible?
Yeah, I got
who's
it.
Responsible?
Yes, let me just respond to that. The first question, as I understand, is that who are responsible for the current crisis? Is that the government, or the petitioners, or the people like the Rogelio Lobato? And that the second question is why the UN is taking so long a time to speak out. Okay, is that correct? Now let me respond to the first question. The current crisis shows the actually complexity of Timorese people interacting with each other. And I think you know better than I do. The responsibility is a collective one. And that you can say that the government took a long time to respond to the petitioner's demand. And that the reason for this is twofold. First, that FDPL hasn't established the institutional mechanism for responding to this kind of demand. In other words, demand was elimination of the discrimination within the defense agency. The leaders of defense agencies, whom I met and discussed a great deal, Tamatan Duak, or Rocky, or Lele, and so forth, they simply are not aware of this discrimination as a problem, or that exists. They insisted that they vote in the jungle for the 24 years, and they suffered a great deal. And they simply do not comprehend the complaints made by the younger recruits. So, the mindset of the people that has been nurtured in the resistance guerrilla movement, becoming the manager of the established defense agency, expected to manage the agency in an accountable way. It is a direct cause of the petitioners running out of the FDPL. And then they marched, and they came to the government, and they brought the complaint to the government. But as I mentioned earlier, that the fact that government do not see it as a legitimate demand for their immediate attention, they took time to recognize this is a real problem. And do remember that the government did set up the commission to address the grievances on the 27th of April, that one day before the riots broke out. Perhaps we can say it was too little too late. It is a lack of capacity or ability on the part of the government leaders to understand the emerging problem. And the same thing can be said about the lack of employment, that the youth are totally frustrated. There is almost no opportunity for the gainful employment. For those leaders who have a job in the government, perhaps they may not feel so desperate. Therefore, there is a need for massive employment creation. Now, whether that can be done through the public work with the subsidized fund is an economic question. But unless you address it, the youth are ready to throw rocks. Furthermore, the people here, like in Rwanda, or for that matter, Mali and other conflict-prone countries I served, they are fearful of each other, and thus they take up arms to defend themselves against the enemies they see in others that may not exist. And once they take action, that invites the counteraction. And that, in the case of people like former Minister Lovato, he indeed saw the need to provide arms to defend against the enemies. Now, secondly, about the United Nations not speaking up, we have been doing that great deal and speaking to both sides, and that both President and Prime Minister and the Leader of the Speaker of the Parliament, Luoro, and the Foreign Minister, Ramaphosa, they have jointly signed a letter addressed to the Secretary General, how much they appreciate the presence of the UNOTEL and even myself. They would like to receive the advice and the guidance on the first basis. The Prime Minister has said and declared time and again that the public demand he will resist at all costs. He has taken many of the advice that I have given, and I continue to do so, but I have been now in the recent weeks since the 28th of April, indeed making a great deal of public speeches. And I have been advised to be careful by my colleagues not to be misunderstood. So we had as recent as yesterday, there was a demonstration at the UNOTEL headquarters. And I went out and met with all the demonstrators, and I indeed responded to their calls. I continue to do so as long as I am indeed permitted to do so. But I have to balance between the private counseling and the megaphone diplomacy. they have to be used to achieve the goals of what is right for the country and what is possible. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Hasegawa. I think we should move on because time is going on. We'll have more opportunity for questions later. You're welcome to stay with us, but I realize it's late there and you have many.
Yeah, I think it's 11 o'clock here, and so if I can be excused,
May, and let me convey from the group our appreciation for all the efforts that you're making there in Dili. We'll turn to the Minister Counselor of the East Timor Embassy, Constancio Pinto, for first remarks, and then I think we'll go in the order of the announcement. Please.
And 5 minutes.
5-10 minutes most. We like to leave enough time for some discussion.
All right. First of all, I'd like to convey to you Ambassador José Luis Guterres' apologies for not being here this morning because he has a meeting with the special representative of the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan that will be going to East Timor in a few days, I think, to conduct another assessment visit and so on. So he, because of that, he won't be able to come to Washington this morning. And secondly, I'd like to thank U.S. Institute of Peace for hosting this event this morning. I think it's very appropriate. It's timely, given that we have all these problems in East Timor. We have questions in front of us, so I don't want to go over the background of the conflict, and Mr. Hasegawa already described it very well. So I think I'm just going to briefly give my personal reaction to these questions, the five questions, so we can give more time to other speakers as well. The question of whether UN withdrawal from East Timor prematurely after 2002, I agree with the with Mr. Hasegawa that there was an intention to extend the UN mission for some time. Expressed by the UN Secretary General. Unfortunately, some members, of course, decided not to extend because they think the East Timorese were ready to carry over the responsibility. But on another side, also, the East Timorese leaders, we also wanted the UN to be out because we want to be independent. So now I think the questions would be whether the UN, during those years, were able to fulfill its mission in terms of setting up the basic foundation for a country, nationhood. That would be the question, and not how long the UN, too soon, whether it was too soon or it was too long for UN to be there. So that's, I think, one of the questions we should be looking into. Because even if the UN, to me, even if the UN stayed there longer, if there is no, if the UN wasn't able to fulfill its mission to set up, the basic foundation to guarantee, stability and so on, political stability in the country, it may not happen. So that should be the question. Now, the question of whether the UN. I also should mention that speaking about the UN mission abroad, I think we've seen a lot of missions out there for a long, long time. I mean, if you look at the UN mission in Lebanon, for example, it's been there forever. Or in Cyprus, for example, it's been there forever. So one may also say, well, the UN mission in East Timor was too short, and so on. But that's not the question. Now, the question of whether the government was prepared to tackle those crises as they appeared. I think so. I think the government was, in a way, was prepared to tackle the issues. But because we have the institutions there, we have the institutions up and running. And one of the experience, I think, if you look at the case, the December 4th incident, when a number of houses were burned down, including Prime Minister's houses were burned down by protesters, where the government was able to make a quick decision to set up a commission and to investigate the case. And the commission would report its finding. Unfortunately, the report never came out. So that I think report probably undermined people's confidence to the government. So as a result of that, future crisis and future commission that will be set up by the government will not have the credibility. People will not, in fact, believe that the commission will carry its mandate and so on. So that's why when we have this crisis, the government did the same thing, set up a commission, and this time the commission was much broader, even including the church and the members of the parliament and so on. But still, the people did not believe that the commission will carry out its mandate. As a result, it failed to do so, its mandate. There is also another question about the combatants, ex-combatants. If you look at the issue, the crisis, it's not actually created by the combatants. It was not by combatants. The petitioner that we are talking about, Mr. Asagawa referred to, also did not create the problem. The crisis actually erupted, caused by unknown individuals that may have been not happy with the government. So I think there was problem within the society that been there for a long time and just waiting time to explode. Mm-hmm. And I think April the 28th was basically the peak of it. So, and unfortunately, the government did not have the ability to foresee issues and prevent them before they become into big crisis. So that, I think, was a big the weaknesses of the government. And I would agree with Mr. Hasegawa that there are certain members in the government that are not cooperative or even interested in finding a quick solution to the problems. Yes, there is, and I think a lot of people know about that. And that probably also contributed to the conflict. Now, the issue of the East and West, did the international community understood the division? It is a surprise that it never happened before. Of course, it existed before the invasion. It was used by both people, the East and the West, and also other terms have been used also, the Kaladi and Firaku, for example. But it was not a big issue in East Timor. During the struggle, every Timorese looked at each other as brothers and sisters. That's all. It may not probably became as a big issue during the struggle, probably because we were forced, to be united now because of the invasion. So everyone must be together and fight for the same cause, which was independence. I think people started to realize, start to dig up their identity, probably. I am the East and I am the West, and so on. So people began to realize themselves. You know. I think we were also in sort of a identity crisis, probably, at that time. Yeah. So when the issue came, some of the people from the East are blaming the people from the West as the collaborators of the Indonesians, that's very hard to accept for someone from the West who also bear the same, had the same problems. You know, they also fought the independence, and then suddenly we came and said, "Well, you're just a bunch of militias or collaborators." That's, I think, it's a big problem. But I think that was not the probably not the main cause of this of the crisis. The East Timorese could have solved the problem, you know, if we tackled it right in the beginning. If we can sit down and talk to each other and explain why you said that and so on. Yeah. I think there was some misunderstanding in this. You know, in this. So, and now it is becoming an issue. When you talk to people in Delhi, what they complain is that, well, my houses, now the houses that belongs to the, well, on both sides, East and West, are burning each other. So it's a big issue now in East Timor, which is unfortunate. Yeah. The last question, lessons learned from what happened in East Timor. Yeah, I think we will learn a great deal from it, especially the United Nations, the international organizations, and international community. I think all of us should stop and look back what went wrong in East Timor and fix it from there. I think that's all my comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pinto. I'm going to turn to Patricia Delaney now. She is a social anthropologist, a Fulbright scholar at the National University of East Timor in 2005-2006, and maybe she can take us a little bit deeper into the issues in this society.
Thank you. I should say that my remarks are predicated on my experience in Timor, which is at a level that's quite different than Mr. Pinto might represent or Mr. Hasegawa. Because I'm an anthropologist, I worked primarily in Timor at the grassroots level. So the thoughts that I'll be sharing briefly this morning are, in essence, not my own, but the perceptions of those Timorese people with whom I worked most closely. And as Mr. Hasegawa said in his statement, at some level, the actual actions of the government, the UN, the international community at this point are perhaps less relevant to what's happening on the ground in Timor than the ways in which they're perceived. And so my experience in this year, this academic year when I was in Timor, was based primarily in Dili. But I was also in Timor from 2002 to 2004 working with the United States Peace Corps. And during that time, I worked closely with Peace Corps volunteers and their counterparts at the grassroots level in the districts outside of Dili. So my thoughts come from that sort of perspective. As all the speakers have said thus far, the current crisis in Timor is incredibly complex, and we could spend all day talking about the various political, military, and security elements. But I think at their heart, they have cultural, social, and economic roots. And so those are the things that I would like to talk about a little bit this morning in terms of some of the underlying structures and factors which have led to the current crisis. I think that perhaps the most important thing to recognize for those sitting here in this comfortable room here in Washington, D.C., is that for most Timorese today, the crisis that the Timorese are facing is worse than what they faced in 1999. If you look at the objective numbers, as an outsider, you might say that that's not the case. Fewer people have been killed, fewer houses have been burned, and so on. But the level of terror, fear, anxiety, frustration among the Timorese population, according to their own reports, is much worse. I wasn't in Timor in 1999, but my friends and colleagues there say that the situation is much worse now, mostly because at least in 99, they knew who the enemy was, and they knew from whom to run, and they knew that eventually, or they hoped at least eventually, it would end, and the international community would come in and support them. Now, the crisis has no end. It seems that with every passing week or every passing day, there's a new wrinkle, a new layer of complexity, a new source of conflict. And so this has created a real sense of anxiety and tremendous fear on the part of the population in East Timor. And I also think, actually, for those of us in the international community that consider ourselves to be supporters of East Timor, those of us that want to be in solidarity with the East Timorese people, the current situation is worse than it was in 1999. You know, Timor has been considered sort of the poster child of UN intervention and of peacekeeping, and there were many thousands of international workers, both with the UN and with other international agencies, that were sympathetic and empathetic towards the situation of the Timorese in 1999. Some of that sympathy, I think, has begun to erode as those of us that have worked in Timor and have supported the Timorese really feel at a loss to understand what's happening and how it is that we might contribute. So with that as a sort of introduction about why the current situation is so incredibly important, I have just three or four brief points about where I think some of the cultural, social, and economic explanations for the current situation lie. If you've been following the popular press at all, the sort of common theme among commentators is there's lots of blame to go around. And Mr. Hosogawa said that he thinks there's a collective responsibility for the current situation in Timor, and I certainly think that that's true. The UN, the international community, the government in Timor, and the Timorese people themselves, as well as those of us elsewhere in the international community. So the first point I'd like to make is one that both previous speakers have touched on briefly, but I think is perhaps the most important thing from the perspective of grassroots perspective in Timor. And that is the disconnect between the current political elites in Timor and the realities on the ground in the country. And here I'm not only speaking of the prime minister, although, of course, he is an easy target for those kinds of sentiments, but for the perception of the government as a whole. If you talk with Timorese, when I interviewed Timorese people earlier this year before the current crisis, the words that you would hear are words like arrogant, disconnected, unaware, unconcerned about the harsh realities that Timorese people face on a daily basis. Timor is the poorest country in Asia. Over half the population lives below the very low poverty line that exists in East Timor. And yet the political elites in Dili live in nice housing, drive nice vehicles, and seem both politically and socially completely disconnected from the realities of everyday people. And in fact, if you look at the language that the petitioners used and the language that those that have supported them have used since the beginning of the crisis, the common refrain that you hear is the government doesn't listen to us. They don't hear us. And the roots of this disconnect are quite complicated. But certainly they have to do with the fact that the majority of the most senior decision makers in Timor today were in exile during the Indonesian occupation of East Timor. They were primarily in Mozambique, elsewhere in the Lusophone world. They didn't participate in the struggle in the way that those who remained in the country did. And for that reason, it's quite easy to understand how they can fail to comprehend the realities on the ground. For those who aren't familiar with the politics of language in East Timor, this is perhaps an easy way to understand some of these disagreements or these difficulties that exist. The vast majority of the government ministers and the folks at senior levels of administration in Timor speak Portuguese fluently. And in fact, many of them insist that Portuguese be the language spoken when you meet with them. Roughly 10% of the population of East Timor spoke Portuguese in 1999 at the end of the Indonesian occupation. It's not a language that is spoken in the districts. It's not a language in which people were educated as a consequence of that, the vast majority of the middle-class Timorese, the Timorese technocrats, the folks that could be actively engaged in rebuilding the country, have been excluded from that process because they don't speak Portuguese. That language issue extends also to many problems in the judicial system, the police, the military. All the laws in the country have been written in Portuguese. The police officers don't speak Portuguese, and you can imagine the sort of difficulties that arise from that. Most Timorese, even those that I know who speak fluent Portuguese, feel that the decision to make Portuguese the national language in conjunction with Tetun, which most people speak, is symbolic of this disconnect between the political elites and the average people on the ground in East Timor. The second point that I would like to make with respect to some of the origins of the current problem have to do with the focus that the United Nations and the international community placed on peacekeeping, governance, the construction of a constitution, and so on, what in the United States we would refer to as democracy and governance kinds of issues. And while these were obviously critically important in East Timor during its transition, they came at the expense of what I think are more fundamental issues in Timor, and that is the economy, livelihoods, and the way that people make a living. I'm reminded of something that a woman in a remote district in Timor told me in 2003. I was interviewing her about her thoughts about the new government and her hopes for the future. And she looked at me and she said, "Mana," which means sister, "you can't eat democracy." And I think it's true that safety and security and political stability are critically important. But it seems in retrospect that the UN and the rest of us in the international community focused exclusively on those issues to the exclusion of social and economic development. When you have unemployment and underemployment of more than 50%, when you have 14,000 people graduating every year from high schools and universities, when you have no hope of employment for them, you have a recipe for political disaster. And I think a lot of what's happened in the last few months can be understood in terms of it's the consequence of pent-up frustration, anger, and lack of hope on the part of the average Timorese people who feel that they have been they have not benefited in any concrete way from the independence that came in 1999. The last point that I would like to make, so I've spoken a little bit about the UN and the international community, a little bit about the government and its disconnect from the Timorese people. The last point that I would like to make has to do with the history and the social and cultural realities of Timor itself. It's a very complicated place with ethnic and regional and other cleavages that have existed for quite a long time. Many of those may have gone sort of under the radar during the resistance to the occupation of the Indonesians, as Mr. Pinto indicated, but they didn't disappear. And for those that were paying attention, even during the time that the UN was in large numbers in East Timor, it was clear that many of the existing rivalries and tensions were beginning to resurface. In fact, a common comment that one would hear, this is again in 2002, 2003, 2004, from people in both Dili and in rural areas was, "Just wait until the UN leaves. Just wait until the Malays, the foreigners, leave, and then we'll see how these differences are settled." And so I think it's important to understand that these tensions, some of which are new and some of which are old, many of which were exploited by the successive waves of colonizers and occupiers that Timor has suffered, be it the Japanese, the Portuguese, the Indonesians, or if I might say the UN, in each case, those foreign forces, that foreign presence has picked and chosen from among the rivalries, has benefited some groups at the exclusion of others, and exacerbated existing tensions. That having been said, I don't think we can blame everything on the presence of outsiders. Another friend of mine who's in Dili at the moment has said, "Everyone keeps saying the government should fix this, the UN should fix this, the international community should fix this. But those aren't the folks that are burning houses and roving in mobs." And so there's a question among the Timorese people, I think, today about where leadership is. Where are the shefisukus, the leaders of villages? Where are the traditional leaders? Why are they not playing a more active role in preventing or at least diminishing the level of violence that exists in society? And the very last comment I would like to make is that I think for those of us in the international community that care about East Timor, for me, the most central point that I've learned from all of this is that the vaguely optimistic, sympathetic, warm and fuzzy feeling that all of us had about East Timor, and I count myself among those. I fell in love with East Timor, and I hope to continue to go back there. I think it perhaps blinded us to the complex realities on the ground. And as a consequence, we were more willing to say, 2 years is enough, 4 years is enough, 5 years is enough. We were more willing to take the Timorese at their word when, as Mr. Pinto said they were ready to be independent. And unless and until we understand the complex historical, cultural, social, and economic realities that exist in Timor, I think that any future peacekeeping mission, any future international presence in the country will simply repeat the same mistakes. It's not a black and white issue, and we need to really understand those complexities if we're to address those challenges, and that will require a long-term commitment, and by long-term I mean 10, 20, 30 years.
Elizabeth Pivens, you've lived in Timor for 4 years and have been concerned about its economy. What's the story?
Concerned about its economy and about many of the things that that Patricia just talked about. So I was the World Bank's representative in Timor-Leste for 4 years, from August 2002 to actually just 6 weeks ago. And I would really like to underline much of what Patricia has already said. I think in the current crisis, it's natural and important to focus on the security sector, and that's what a lot of people focus on in the discussions these days. And it's important to do that because there are, as we have seen, deep institutional weaknesses specific to each, the police force and the army, which were compounded by the breakdown of command and communication in both forces that have precipitated the crisis, and the scope that it took, the magnitude that it took, has a lot to do with that. Yet, I think it's equally important to recognize other very important fault lines that have simmered for a long time, that have considerably contributed to the recent developments, and that in my mind would have sparked violence at some point. Even in absence of the petitioner's problem, which was a problem that, you know, just precipitated what happened. And I think these long-term fault lines include unrealistic expectations over the fruits of independence, combined with a complete absence of communication over that. You know, so to an extent one feels with the government, because I think, as Mr. Hasegawa said, in their way, and we'll come back to that later, they did try very hard, but they failed to communicate to the population that it's really hard to start a government from scratch. So that imbalance between the dividends that people expected from independence, and which are really unimaginably unrealistic when you talk to people, and no communication about how difficult it really is. Then secondly, and Patricia underlined this as her first point, the disconnect between the top leadership and the people. Not everybody in government, and I think one also needs to start making distinctions and look at what did go right and where one might find models for how to do things better. But the top leadership, who had lived outside of Timor for 24 years, do not know their people, and they are not making any attempt at knowing their people. Their approach is top-down, control-oriented, not consultative. There's no information, no useful information that goes out from the government to the people. It goes out in Portuguese, which is not useful to the people. There's very little empathy with the people. Government tried in its way. Some of you were there, may have attended some of the open government meetings that government organized, where they took the cabinet to the districts. And I attended several of those, and it made my stomach cringe, because rather than listening to the people, what the government did was talk down on the people. And that doesn't go down well in Timor. People are very quiet about it, but it doesn't go down well. So, you know, they almost would have better not had those district meetings. A deep distrust on the part of the government of the capacity of younger people and the capacity of the government, of the communities. So thinking that younger people, because they were educated in Indonesia, under Indonesia, had no capacity for that reason, which is very, very mistaken. In fact, there is a lot of capacity in Timor. This myth about lack of capacity is really a myth in my mind. There is a lot of capacity among the younger people, and there is a lot of capacity in the communities whose traditional systems display quite a bit of integrity and on which one can build. But unfortunately, the government did not see that. This is despite the fact that these same communities for 24 years displayed a lot of capacity and integrity in the struggle. So it was obvious that there was capacity there, not the kind of capacity that we call capacity, which is education in universities, etc., but a capacity to organize and to deal with resources honestly in the context of the struggle was certainly there. Then I would say also a continuing and deepening erosion of democratic principles. And as much as I agree with Patricia that, you know, people say we cannot eat democracy, I think people also in Timor feel very strongly about wanting democracy. And so the militarization of the police, a police force that goes around looking like an enemy with very heavy weapons, a lot of abuse by police officers, the criminalization of defamation, which was kind of reintroduced under the rug and then with the penal code earlier this year confirmed, government's interference with parliament and, importantly, with the prosecution. Lack of progress on the election law, kind of stalling, which gave everybody the impression that Fretilin, well, the government and therefore Fretilin, would pass an election law at the last minute with dispositions that would be favorable to Fretilin. An increasing entanglement between business and politics is another element. Fretilin intimidation in local elections, which took place on a rolling schedule about 18 to 12 months ago. And then, as we now know, alleged distribution of weapons by Fretilin elements. So this combined effect of really moving away of democratic principles, I think, was also very corrosive. Another element of that is impunity. In December 2002, there were riots that were investigated, but no consequences to that investigation, neither nationally nor in the international community, nor on the part of the UN. Events, altercations between the police and the army in Los Palos in early 2004, No report ever came out of that investigation, although it worried the population deeply that the police forces and FFDTL, the army, started to be at odds, well, had been at odds with each other from the beginning, but that started to come out in altercations. The conviction of one Secretary of State for killing somebody while drunk and driving, even though, and being maintained in the cabinet, even though that had been happened. The presence of Minister Rogerio Lobato in the cabinet, who is a convicted criminal already in Angola from way back, and then continued to display an attitude that was clearly not of integrity, with a latest incident in November 2005 where he tried to arrest somebody for which he has no powers, of course, and then fractured the skull of the person when beating him. No censure. And then I would also mention deeper fault lines, some of which Patricia mentioned, that really prevented the building of a national identity. So the previous identity was one of all against Indonesia. The new identity was just not being built. And I think the marginalization of youth has a lot to do with that. And of course, the language policy, the de facto use of Portuguese only by the government, and its consequences for education and justice systems in particular, which should be very close to the people and were not at all. And then obviously also increased poverty, unemployment, lack of access to public services, and no communication as to why, why it is so difficult to start a government from scratch. As a consequence of all this, I think we should also not forget this is a political crisis. There was an ever-growing alienation between the government, on the one hand, stubbornly convinced of its own right, but blind to what was happening around it, and the president and the church, on the other hand, and the church is a formidable force in Timor-Leste. And so the latter two, you could see over the years, at least that I was there, gradually became more bitter about their lack of influence and really withdrew their support. Even last year in April, when there were demonstrations organized by the church against the government, the president himself came out to calm everything down and say, look, if you don't like your government, we have elections in 2007. That's the time to make that clear. So he in early tensions, and there have been tensions over the 4 years that I was there, it's often forgotten. But in earlier tensions, the church and the president would be conciliatory figures. In this last crisis, they were not. And I think the absence of the public of public presentations by the president was very noted. The church over the past year has been combative more than reconciliatory. I think it's important that all these factors be very carefully analyzed before one move to designing solutions for the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. We have a little bit less time for discussion, and I hope I'll ask people to be brief, but I'll ask first Yoav Carney, and then I'll come around this way. Yoav.
My name is Yoav Carney, a journalist and author here in Washington. I was a senior fellow at QSAP a couple of years ago, and I studied certain aspects of East Timor's liberation struggle in comparison with the independence struggle of other small nations. At that time, I was full of praises for a certain fateful moment in the evolution of their struggle, in which in early 1999, contrary, or almost counterintuitively, the leadership of the resistance in East Timor decided not to respond in kind to the militias unleashed or encouraged or at least certainly tolerated by the Indonesians, thus avoiding giving the Indonesians the pretext of resolving a civil war in East Timor and evading the independence process. I'm in no position to match the profundity of your speakers, but if you let me make quickly a couple of points. I think that what would be of particular interest to this institution is mistakes made in the course of peacekeeping or conflict resolution. And I dare to say, and would love to be challenged on that, that a certain, if I may say so, Lusophone romanticism played a role in handing power to Mari Alkatiri and his Fretilin party in 2002, mm-hmm. unnecessarily so, and with hindsight, in the most immoral and inappropriate way. I'm saying it with great reluctance because it involved a heroic figure in the history of conflict resolution and peacekeeping, a man who died in the course of his contribution to world peace, and that is José de Melo, who was the, to all intents and purposes, the High Commissioner, the autocratic emperor of East Timor for a period of about 2 years between 1999 and 2002. And he did not have to make Alkatiri the head of a provisional government in 2001. And that smacked very much of the transition process the Portuguese instigated in Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau in 1974 and 1975, in which they handed power to entrenched revolutionary elites without ever bothering to go about electoral processes and asking the people. And the end result is well known. Now, Alkatiri is really a student and a product of third world revolutionarism of the 1970s. And there are two potent symbols in East Timor that testify to that. One is you land at President Nicolau Lobato Airport, which is a piece of historical nonsense, clearly a fraud perpetrated on the people of East Timor. Lobato, having been the head of Fretilin, of the resistance between 1976 and 1978, when he died at the hands of the Indonesians, and making November 28th the day of independence of East Timor. Again, a day of independence was proclaimed by Fretilin in 1975 in a way that invited the Indonesians in. And there was absolutely no need for that. It was about defiance, provoking, showing contempt for anything that happened in East Timor between 1975 and 1999. And the ease with which the UN and Western institutions and many foreigners walked into the Alkatiri trap is really mind-boggling. The Fretilin people all along held Xanana Gusmão in complete contempt. They had to accept him because he was a proven hero of the resistance. They thought of him as a laughable figure, a man who is not entirely balanced, certainly no political match for their acumen, and they knew he was overwhelmingly popular. He was advised by some of his associates to, in fact, quit the presidency, form a political party, and defeat Alkatiri in a parliamentary election, but he never had, at least at the time, the guts to do it. I just want to add one more thing, and then I'll fall silent, which is the matter of the language. The language, most practical, sadly, tragically, but inevitably in East Timor, is Bahasa Indonesian. And that is a language that should have become the official language of East Timor. Whether you like it or not, the Indonesians created something of a territorial unit of East Timor. If I'm not mistaken, under the Portuguese, they had about either 11 or 17 kilometers of paved roads. The Indonesians really connected East Timor, made it possible for one to travel reasonably safely from one end of the country to the other with great difficulties, as old hands of East Timor know. But Bahasa Indonesian should. I had the pleasure of spending a weekend with José Ramos Horta, the foreign minister. He traveled from Dili to the farthest end, eastern end of East Timor. And all along outside of Dili, he was unable to converse with anyone because no one spoke Tetum and no one spoke Portuguese. And that was so emblematic of that situation. And it's too bad that people such as Ramos Horta, who certainly understood what was going on, did not stand up to Al-Kathiri earlier.
Thank you.
I just want to say a little bit when my speaker mentioned about local government, because I was working with local government as well.
Introduce yourself.
My name is Lucas. I'm a student. I just want to say about that situation in East Timor. Make all the students for outside from East Timor very preoccupied and stressed. We don't want to recognize as the poorest country in the Asia, of course, and also now we don't want to be recognized as the troublemakers in Asia as well. So we don't want that. That's why I think the real problem now is government with people because of no transparency. When I work with government, as Mrs. Patrice just mentioned that, why the civilians do something to prevent the conflict? I think this is, I was a local government, we have no power to do anything because everything centralized in Delhi. In central, never listen, even though we make report like 100 pages, but the result never coming up. So that's why I think this is one thing that government should see together in order to identify the root of the problem. To solve first. And the next is, we are happy about United Nations intervention to East Timor. It was great. Because if United Nations intervention to East Timor, all people will die to save us. At the time, that during the transitional government of East Timor, they prepared administration very well. However, after election, the political situation has been changed completely. The new government set up new extraordinary rules to the local government, indirect way in order to keep some people away. So this is the main problem. That's why now, mostly people who, for example, like my generation, we prefer to go out from East Timor instead of work in government with a lot of problem. Because people in the national level listen to people in the district. That's the problem. That's why myself, I decided to go out from East Timor to get more education. I think government should look at this. This is the main problem. For example, if I have problem with someone, if he or me stay in the middle to solve the problem, it will not happen. I said, no, we need someone come to the middle to find a way to put together. I will not listen to you. For example, government now. Government still exists there. And they try to find them to encourage people come together. No one listen to them, of course. You are create problem, and you stand there and invite us come and talk with you. It is impossible.
Thank you very much.
Patricia Fagan, Georgetown University. Well, I want to thank the presenters. It was really an excellent array of discussions, which enlightened us all. A decade ago, I had a grant from USIP, in which I used to write about the problems of the international community in a post-conflict intervention and support. And the point I made in what I wrote was that there are dangers when the international community withdraws too soon. But at that time it was not a very popular position because the international community was very set on establishing exit strategies and on not engaging in mission. So here we are sitting around the table discussing that the internet and agreeing that the international community probably withdrew too soon. Mm-hmm. However, I don't think that's really the question. It's not withdraw too soon altogether or not withdraw at all. It's what should the international community do after the crisis? There have been kilos of articles and discussions about international response to disasters, to emergencies, to post-war immediately, and they make a lot of mistakes, as apparently they did, as we know they did in Timor. But what happens after the emergency? Now, this is speculative, so I'm asking the speakers to comment if the international community stayed longer, what should they have done to support the capacity building, the economy, and all the issues that you've raised?
Before you respond, let me get a few other people in. Yes?
Sarah Kinson is coming. I wanted to ask the way we're representing sort of in threes, you know, the international community.
Can you stand up? I'm having trouble hearing you.
The international community, the government, and civil society, or the Timorese people. And I think we're looking at a large shakeup in the Timorese government, such as it is. And I guess my question is, how cohesive is it as one unit? And could you talk more about the elements of the government and how mm-hmm. they're working? You were speaking about local government and its disconnect from Dili. Certainly, between there are some ministries that are much more powerful and some that have been more ignored. As we face this shakeup and certainly this stepping down of ministers and secretaries of state, what remains and what which elements of the government do you really think are going to hold? Hold the water until we get to the elections in
2000. Let me take one more person. I think
you're. Hey, hi. My name's Dave Sharma from the Australian Embassy. I just had one quick comment about the downsizing of the UN mission in a couple of years ago now. Australia did argue at the time that we did support as UN and peacekeeping troops, but I think the argument of 3 years ago is quite different to the argument now. The argument then was, were external threats to East Timor's territorial integrity sufficient to warrant a continued peacekeeping presence? And the judgment that we reached at the time was no, and that the primary threats were likely to come from issues of internal governance and the capacity of state institutions. And at the time, we did argue, and we've continued to sense, that the international community and donors should remain engaged in East Timor to bolster those very institutions. I just also had two questions for the panel, and thanks very much for your presentations. One was, I think the discussions today have suggested there was a certain inevitability about this crisis that we've seen now, that the drivers were long-term. But the particular precipitant of what's taken place was the decision to sack 595 mm-hmm. members of the armed forces of 1,500, which is obviously a pretty dramatic move. I just wondered, I mean, do you think that if it wasn't for that decision, something else would have arisen that would have led to the same sort of outcome or not? And secondly, again, drawing from your presentations, most of the failings that I've gleaned from what you've said point to failures of the political leadership and class and poor political decision-making. And I'm wondering, in that sort of situation, just to what extent can the international community step in and address these things when a large part of the responsibility rests on Timorese shoulders?
Okay, I'm going to go back through the panel. Unfortunately, we have to give up the room at 11, so I'm going to ask everybody to be brief. And I'm going to go back through the panel in reverse order. So, Elizabeth, mm-hmm. to you first. The questions I have on the table are what should the UN have done? How mm-hmm. cohesive is the government?
Did
the sacking precipitate this, or would something else have precipitated it? Yeah. And what about the responsibility of the political class?
Yeah. First, to the gentleman's points, which are well taken, I do think the situation is a little bit more complex than, you know, the Janana Marie dichotomy that sometimes people tend to lounge to. I do think there is a reflex on the international community, not just in Timor, but in other countries as well, after crises like 99, to reach out to the exiled communities. We see that in Iraq, we see that in Afghanistan, and it's understandable. They hang around here, they have our vocabulary, but they don't know their people anymore. And I think this is something we really need to reflect on. With respect to how Marie and the Mozambique clique came to government, I think that's a very interesting question. I wasn't there when this happened. I think it is possibly a little bit more complex than just the Lusophone reflex, but that's there, and also the reflex towards exile. But I do want to remind that Fretilin won the elections. You know, so this is this is to all of us has been a difficult to understand. But people in Timor, as much as they dislike the leadership of Fretilin, they have this soulmate kind of bond with Fretilin that stems from the resistance. And people didn't quite make understood how this would lead to the government that they have. And if there were elections today, it's still not clear whether Fretilin would lose.
We call it here the power of incumbency.
I'm not sure whether it's the power of incumbency rather than the power of history. And but anyway, and also just on the Portuguese, Janana also supported the Portuguese, unfortunately, even though he understood the people much better. What should the international community have done? Well, I do think it was a mistake to withdraw peacekeeping forces. Even leaving a small contingent as a signaling effect for a long time, not for 5 years, but 10, 15, is important as a signaling effect, and also to be able to intervene rapidly when things happen. The institution, the lack, complete lack of institution building in security sectors is something that one needs to look at. Ludovic, who is about to issue an article about that, it might have been published in the meantime, it's excellent, and we should all take a look at that. With respect to capacity building, which is another big topic, first of all, I would want to underline again, there is capacity in Timor. It's just not drawn out at the right levels. There's no capacity to speak Portuguese, but there is capacity. And I would really like the international community to start using the word institution building rather than capacity building, because capacity building drives us to put internationals in place, do training of all kinds of sorts, all very interesting, but not in the context of building an institution. And this is also where we can learn some of the lessons in Timor, because some institutions in Timor are functioning reasonably well. And it is because the approach to them has been one of institution building. And I would draw the attention to the Banking and Payments Authority. It's not what you would kind of think of easily, but that's an institution that is functioning very well in Timor. Almost entirely Timorese right now. Almost no internationals left anymore. The other institution I would look at is the Ministry of Health. You know, lots of problems still with health in the country, but that ministry, with a clear, very good leadership of the minister, has been able to build itself a vision, have a strategy, focus on results, and build slowly but surely the human resources that are necessary to function. And I would also underline leadership. And the example of the Ministry of Health shows how important leadership is. In countries where you have no institutions to start with, the leadership and the integrity of leadership is phenomenally important. And as an international community, we may want to think about programs that focus on that, that allow leaders to think about how they exercise leadership and management, get them in contact with other people who at same levels, president, prime minister, have had similar problems. So talk more about the diversity in the government. I did a little bit. There is a lot of diversity. And before we jump to conclusions and say that this government isn't worth anything, that's just so not true. There is a spectrum from very good leadership and organization to very, very poor leadership and organization, and it's important to look at that. Would something else have arisen? Yes, I think so. It would probably not have taken this form so large, so rapidly, but I think many of us were very worried about what would have happened around the Fretilin Congress, which kind of got, which happened on May the 17th to 19th, and kind of got folded into all this, and also around the elections. I think all these fault lines that we talked about would have erupted in these contexts.
Patricia Delaney?
I won't go through all of the questions. I'll say that I would agree with much of what Elizabeth has just said, so I'll just present a couple of other quick quick ideas. In terms of what the international community could have done, I would also actually say what we might yet do, given that we, you know, the title of the talk today is Rebuilding Timor Again. I think perhaps we have a unique opportunity to correct some of the mistakes that we made in the past, and I think among the things that we need to make sure the next phase of assistance to Timor provides is a greater space for that capacity that does exist, as Elizabeth said, and as several of the other speakers have mentioned. That would mean a proactive policy on the part of both the UN and the other international agencies that will be providing assistance to Timor to Timorize the workforce. And I think it would most likely also entail some fairly, I would say, robust discussions on the part of the international community with the political elites in Timor about the language issue specifically, and about the ability to work to at least have Bahasa continue to be a working language in which people can actually get things done, so that many people, like our colleagues around the table today, who felt that they had to leave Timor because they weren't able to contribute, so that they can participate in the process of rebirth and regrowth and development in Timor. I think in doing that, you would also avoid one of the major mistakes that the international community made during the first phase, and that is to send in a wave, a series of waves of international staff in the UN, in the Peace Corps, where I worked, in different international agencies that didn't know Timor and didn't speak any of the languages that the people in Timor speak. So there were many UN personnel who not only didn't speak Bahasa or Tetun or Portuguese, they only spoke English and whatever their native language happened to be. And so it required that the Timorese staff with whom they were working speak English. So the language question isn't just a matter of the Portuguese issue. It's a matter of having policies in place so that those that are building capacity are actually able to do that, and that you have folks that have appropriate language skills and know the history of the country. The other issue that I would mention builds on what our friend Lucas mentioned, and this is the idea that in a place like Timor, where there are lots of fractures and lots of differences, mediation, I think, will continue to be an important process. And it's important to recognize that the sort of black and white divisions that we thought existed, we, the international community, thought existed, this, you know, there, it's everyone against the Indonesians, but it's much more complicated than that, and that there are multiple tensions at multiple levels that will continue to need to be resolved. So you need leadership for that, as Elizabeth said, but I think you also need conflict resolution, you need mediators, you need people who can help the Timorese to navigate those differences and resolve them, as opposed to just sort of sweeping them under the rug, which is what had been happening. And last but not least, in response to the Australian colleague's question, I also agree that if this had not been the trigger, something else most likely would have been, unless we had been able to address all of these other issues that we've been discussing. So I don't think the petitioners were the exclusive trigger. It could have been any number of other things. Sure. But I do think we have an opportunity to get it right now and to avoid the perpetuation of this cycle if we address some of these more fundamental issues.
Ministro Consigliero.
Well, I think my previous speakers have describe it very well. They've spoken, so my words. So I just want to say that what we're looking to today is to have the UN back into East Timor. The government of East Timor have requested the UN should extend, and I think there will be negotiations about the framework of the UN future mission in East Timor. Of course, I would agree with Patricia and Elizabeth about security issues. It's very important because of the election of 2007. I think it's very important that the people in April or May 2007 feel safe to go to voting stations, and so that, you know, especially to ensure a free and fair election in 2007. The charm is the question about the fighting of the 600 soldiers. I sometimes feel it's mind-boggling, personal view, You don't see this happen in many other countries, in the United States. So it's mind-boggling. But I just don't understand whose decision to fire the 600. Of course, Tarmat and Ruat, but I understand that there are some international advisors there. So who advised that must be also find out. If he was advised by someone from an international advisor, so something must be wrong here. So, yeah, but of course the 600 is a big problem, 600 people, yeah. And everyone was talking about it. In April, when I was in East Timor, even the street vendor, he knew that it's a big problem. So it doesn't take rocket scientists to understand that. So I think that's all.
Thank you. Before concluding, let me just note, by way of advertising for USIP, that there are one report already out on measuring progress in societies emerging from conflict. I dare say if we had applied some means of measuring progress, we might have avoided some problems in East Timor. And that report is partly authored by Mike Jajitz. And then there's another one about to hit the streets from Beth DeGrasse and Christina Kahn on governance in societies emerging from conflict, which I think has very important applications to this situation. I want to thank the panel, including Ambassador Hasegawa. It's very rare that in the aftermath of a crisis you can put a scholar, an international civil servant, and a representative of a government, and a UN representative in the country on a panel and expect such a wide degree of agreement about what happened, what's wrong. And I guess it's my hope that this will lead on to wide areas of agreement on how to fix the problems. And I thank you all very much.